This is the MCrit Podcast, where we bring upstairs care downstairs. Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is another MCrit Podcast. So you folks have been putting so many topic suggestions on the site, and I really appreciate it. We're going to do a lot of them coming up in the future. I was about to do one today, but I've been getting an onslaught of emails about the awake intubation video. And people like the video, but they say, when would we actually use awake intubation? I don't get it. Who is this for? I don't see many patients I could consider an awake intubation in, even if I think they're a difficult airway. So I figured we'd have to address that right away. Now, awake intubation is for any patient who you predict to be a difficult airway. And predicting that is tough. There's been a lot of schema out there, and some of them don't work at all, and most of them work with only limited success. I still think the easiest and best is the one that's put forth in Ron Wall's class, the emergency airway management class, and that's the Lemon Law. And I'll put that up on the show notes. I don't want to belabor that. You can take a look. But if you predict they're difficult and you have time, they should be done awake. And then that brings up the question, well, I don't have time. Why would I be intubating these patients in the first place if they weren't crashing in front of me? And so that's what this podcast is about. Who needs intubation is the question we need to answer first. Now, Ron Wall's class and the book, Emergency Airway Management, they also have a list of people that need intubation. But I'm going to say I disagree with a bunch of these. And so I'll tell you when I think you should intubate a patient. The first group that requires intubation is easy. They're the crash airways. Now, the airway course defines crash as dead or nearly dead. I don't think they need to be that bad off to qualify as crash. For me, a crash is an apneic patient. You have an apneic patient, that's a crash airway. It's crash because you can't take 10, 15 minutes to do anything else except proceed to immediate intubation, and that intubation should be done RSI, paralytics on board, unless you could swear on your life that the patient has no life. If they're in cardiac arrest, sure, you don't need meds. But even if they're peri-arrest, I would say push the paralytic, give yourself the best chance of first pass success. So crash airway, easy. They're definitely going to need intubation. They're not breathing and not appropriate candidates for awake intubation. All right, let's go through the others on the airway class list. Can't maintain an airway, can't maintain ventilation or oxygenation, and expected decline in clinical course. So they're given crash plus these four other reasons for intubation. And I got to say, I disagree with most of those. So can't protect your airway. Well, that's a good one, as long as you're figuring out who those patients are. And Ron Wall's book very clearly states it's not someone without a gag reflex. Up to a third of the population doesn't have a gag reflex. That's a bad measure. Patients that can't manage their secretions. Get a patient, they're obtunded and drools pooling in their mouth and falling over their lips. Probably a patient that benefits from intubation. I will add to that any obtunded patient that has vomited. If they're obtunded and they vomited once, they're getting a tube in my book because I'm not waiting for that second time. I was lucky enough if I managed to get to them in time to suction out that first episode of emesis. So we got crash airway, we got can't protect airways. The third one for me, and it's discussed in the book, but not really in this section, is the patient who's at risk of loss of an airway. And those are your angioedema patients, your anaphylaxis patients, your trauma patients who've had trauma to their neck. Those patients require intubation. Now you get to the category that I just don't agree with, which is can't maintain ventilation, can't maintain oxygenation. I don't care if they can't do either of those things. It doesn't mean they need to be intubated. It means they need aggressive intervention, but not necessarily intubation. And for me, that intervention almost always is going to be non-invasive ventilation. And if you have questions about that, see the podcast. I'll put the link in the show notes. So if I have a patient who's not maintaining oxygenation, but I think their course is one that will get better in the ED, I'm not going to intubate them. Same thing for ventilatory problems like asthma or COPD. If I think I could get them better, they're not going to get intubated, even though right now their oxygenation or ventilation is crap. And that brings us to the last one, and the most important one, which is expected decline in clinical situation. And this is it. This is the key. If they're okay now, but they're going to get worse, it's better to intubate them now. And this is what feeds into the can't maintain oxygenation and ventilation. If they are not maintaining it, but I expect their clinical course to get no better, then I'll intubate them. If I expect their clinical course to be one that's going to reverse, then I won't. And so that's the most important. So those were the four that they discuss in Ronwald's book, but there's a fifth that's not mentioned and is really important for ED critical care. It's a patient with a supply-demand imbalance. Their supply of oxygen to their tissues is very low, so you want to take away their demand. And the lungs are a huge demand. When you're in the midst of a SIRS response, your tachypneic, 50% of your metabolic load could be going to the lungs for no good reason. They don't need it. But the patient has this massive hyperpnea and tachypnea, and they're wasting all this energy feeding those lungs. Well, if we sedate them and we breathe for them, then there's a lot more oxygen available for the tissues. So how does this feed into the question at hand, which is, who could you do an awake intubation on? Well, you could do an awake intubation on everyone except the crash airway, and that's the key, is that all these other reasons give you time. Now, in that can't protect the airway, you usually have a ton of time. In the possible loss of an airway, these are the best patients to do awake intubation on, because if you paralyze them and can't tube them, you've promised them a cut in the neck, while with awake intubation, you haven't lost ground. Can't maintain oxygenation or ventilation, and you expect their course to decline, put them on non-invasive. Temporize. You could do the awake intubation while they're on the non-invasive. In fact, it works really well because you just hook a nebulizer up to that non-invasive mask and it's forcing the nebulized lidocaine into their airway. And you could do a very pretty awake intubation on a patient on non-invasive. Supply-demand imbalance, you're intubating semi-electively. You could do awake intubation on these patients if you predict them to be difficult. So essentially, there's no one I can't do awake intubation on except for the crash airway. Now, I'll tell you a little story to finish off this podcast because it feeds into this question of who is suitable for awake intubation, and it feeds into the question of who needs intubation in the first place. We had a 70-year-old woman, pedestrian struck, neighborhood I work in, Elmhurst, Queens, in New York City. People are very scary drivers, and pedestrians, beware. So they knocked this 70-year-old with a pretty good hit off that front bumper. She arrived conscious, looked to be in extreme amounts of pain, started working her up, got the trauma team down. Her portable x-ray showed multiple rib fractures, left side of her chest, right femur fracture. Her fast exam was negative. Surgeons took her to CT scan. While at CT, the IV line blew as the IV contrast was being injected. So now she has an arm full of contrast and a non-contrast CT. They brought her back to my trauma room. And this woman was pretty sick. She's probably losing a lot of blood into that leg. And her blood pressure was hovering at the 45 systolic range. She'd get some blood, some FFP, come up a little bit. She dropped back down. And during the second or third plummet of her blood pressure, I told the trauma team, I think it's time to intubate this woman with the flail chest and the bleeding and the hypotension. And her clinical course didn't seem like she'd be getting better in the next hour or so. I had, I think, maybe 12 surgeons there, myself and my first year EM resident. And all the surgeons turned to me and said, why are you going to intubate this patient? Now, this is a huge step forward for me because when I first arrived, they would have said, you're not intubating this patient. And they've since learned that that doesn't go over very well. Now they ask. But it just brought home to me that these guys don't get it. That for them, since this patient was conscious, since her saturation on a non-rebreather was 97%, they can't see why I'd intubate her with the flail chest, the bleeding, and the femur fracture. Because they don't understand that expected clinical decline is the most important reason to intubate. Well, needless to say, there was some educational activity that occurred, and we decided we would indeed intubate this patient. But again, at this point, her blood pressure, maybe 50 systolic, not so great. You know from the trauma podcast, 65 MAP is what we like to see in our trauma patients in my shop. Not too high, not too low. 50 systolic, that's low. So I want her intubated. I think she's not going to be doing so well in the next even 10 minutes or so as we pound in more blood products. She's already not looking so great. She's getting sleepy. She might have a little subarachnoid now that we look at the CT a little more closely. Not so pleased with leaving this woman with her airway unprotected. Thing is, though, when these trauma patients, if you intubate them conventionally, at this point, their BP plummets. You convert them from negative to positive pressure ventilation in their thorax. Venous return goes to crap, and you're going to be using some modicum of sedation. That's a good way to take away their endogenous sympathetic tone, and they drop their blood pressure from that. This wouldn't have worked out so well in this older woman. I don't think she would have tolerated the 20 systolic. So here's what I thought. I thought, why don't I awake intubate this woman? I didn't predict her to be a difficult airway, though she was still in a seat collar. But what I wanted is for her to continue spontaneously breathing until we could get her MAP up with additional blood, FFP, and platelets. So we decided to wake intubate her, and it worked out very, very nicely. So I gave her the glycopyrrolate. We made it maybe 5 minutes, suctioned out her mouth, dried it with some gauze, and I started nebulizing in a little bit of lidocaine during those first 5 minutes. Not sure how much we got, but I loaded up my MAD with a bunch more of 4% lidocaine, and I started spraying the back of her oropharynx. And at first, she had a gag reflex, and after a little spraying, she didn't, and she was still spontaneously breathing throughout. I gave her a smidgen of ketamine. I gave her 10 milligrams of ketamine, really just to get pain augmentation in case I did have a little bit of incomplete topical anesthesia of her airway. She was still very much awake, breathing throughout. And then we intubated her with a Bonfi. Bonfi is a fiber optic stylet. It fits into an endotracheal tube. It has a camera on its tip. You could see exactly what you're coming up against on a screen. The beauty of this is I don't need to put a laryngoscope in her mouth, so I don't need as much topical anesthesia. We visualized her cords, popped the tube in. We sprayed a little lidocaine down the tube. She coughed, anesthetized the lower part of her cords in case we didn't get it fully with our MAD atomizer device. And now I have a woman spontaneously breathing, quite comfortable, with an endotracheal tube through her cords. And so I put her on, the ventilator on CPAP, but I didn't really give her much. I gave her 5 of pressure support, no PEEP, and left it at that until we got her blood pressure up. And so she got another 2 units of blood, 2 units of FFP, 6-pack of platelets. Now her MAP was 70. And at this point, I was able to give her a little sedation and put her on assist control. So awake intubation, not for predicted difficult airway, but to allow continued spontaneous ventilation in the hemodynamically unstable patient. Now this worked very nicely. I'm not saying do this yet. I want to think about this some more. I want to really go through the various permutations of this before I recommend it. But it's really a solution to a problem I've been having for a long time, which is in these really hypotensive trauma patients, once you intubate them conventionally, they have a tendency to go into cardiac arrest. All right, tell me your thoughts. What do you think? Is it a horrible idea, good idea? Awake intubation for hemodynamic instability to allow further resuscitation before putting them on positive pressure ventilation. Give me your thoughts. All right, if you like the MCRIT podcast, please, please, please go to iTunes, give us a 5-star review. If you have a second, write an actual review. I'd really appreciate it. It means a lot to your standings on iTunes. It would really help me out. So if you like the podcast, please go do that. All right, keep the show suggestions coming in. Send me your questions. I love communicating with you, and I will talk to you in a week or so. Bye-bye.